Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Let me apologize up front for the audio quality. I am not recording in my normal podcasting studio. You see, in the States, it's Thanksgiving today, and my house is filled with the warm comforts of my wife's family and all of their children. So, of course, I needed to leave and find a place to record a podcast, which is what I'm doing now. And the topic for today is upper airway obstruction. And it was suggested by Josh Farkas in the form of a set of tweet rants based on his disdain for the contents of this article. And he suggested I might want to take a look and record a podcast about it. And I agree with him. This is certainly worthy of commentary. So this is by Eskinder et al. It's in the New England Journal. It is, I think, typical of review articles in these big journals in that I think it has a problem of scope. I don't know how an article could succeed on upper airway obstruction in a medicine journal, but there you go. It is suffering from the same things that most bad presentations suffer from, which is a failure to zoom in. If you're going to give a broad-based review of an enormous topic, what you will get is basically milquetoast. It's not going to give you any new information, any cutting edge stuff, and instead is just going to give a host of generalities. And if you're going to cover both peds and adult, chronic and acute conditions, well, then this is what is going to turn out. Now, I didn't hate this article quite as much as I think Josh did, but that's because there's not too much to inspire hatred. Now, one of the major problems with this article is there's some very bad messages that are just sloppy. I will give you one. It's not a direct quote because I'm leaving out the numbers. They're not relevant, but the gist is there. And so I will quote, "During the past decade, video laryngoscopy has been associated with an increase in success rates of first pass intubation and a decrease in success rates of direct laryngoscopy." No, it hasn't. No, that's not what happened in the past decade. In two centers in South Korea, that happened. And that's what their quoted article stated, and that's all well and good. So you could say, in some centers, or in one article, or in one study, and that would be just fine. But to make a broad-based generalization, during the past decade, video laryngoscopy rates have gone up, but that has caused a decrease in the success rates of direct laryngoscopy, and apply that to the whole of airway management is just crazy and a bad message and untrue, and maybe talking about the particularity of the fact that these centers went exclusively to hyperangulated video laryngoscopes may have explained some of the decrease in success rate at those two centers. But even that doesn't really help you because it is just in those two centers. And I don't think there's any generalization to be made at all. So, I mean, that's just one example of many statements in this article that really were not well wrought and should have been caught in the editorial process. I'm not sure if the editor for this piece was an expert in the management of upper airway obstruction. Hopefully, the peer reviewers it was sent to were, but I'm not sure if they were. So, that's how you wind up with something like this. It discusses anatomy, and for what that's worth, it's just fine. There's a discussion of the physical exam of a patient with acute upper airway obstruction, but instead of talking about the specifics of that particular issue, it inexplicably spends time discussing the standard airway assessment for difficulty of elective patients coming to the operating room. These grading scales have zero relevance to patients with acute upper airway obstruction, in whom you've already made the decision something is bad with their airway, and now you're just trying to decide, should I intubate them or not, versus a patient coming in for an operation to decide, are they going to potentially be an unexpected, difficult airway. So, a completely useless discussion that makes me question whether the authors truly understand what they're talking about outside the perspective of ENT. These are all ear, nose, and throat surgeons writing this article. There is then a 1 to 2 paragraph long discussion of each of the individual conditions that go into the complete breadth of upper airway obstruction. And those are fine for what they're worth, but since there's so little detail on each one, you're not going to be able to get very much out of it. And I really question who the target audience of these review articles like this really are. They're certainly not to specialists, and if they're for generalists, I think you'd be much better suited to having a discussion of who needs to be hospitalized, who needs to be referred, and when you should be really scared and dial 911. But be that as it may. Then we get to the truly inexplicable aspects of the article. For instance, a relatively, given the space constraints, extensive discussion of the Difficult Airway Society failed airway algorithm. Now, anyone who performs airway management knows a failed airway algorithm is for a patient you did not predict to be difficult, and you've proceeded with rapid sequence intubation or induction, and then you're like, oh, crap, I can't intubate. And so this is the failed airway algorithm for unanticipated difficult airway. Perhaps patients who don't have acute upper airway obstructions, in which case you would recognize before you started that they could be difficult and would never perform an RSI in a patient who had that potential difficulty. Or if you decided to, it's with an incredible amount of trepidation and preparation for failback plans. There's then a discussion of Sagamidex, the reversal agent for rocuronium. Again, what was the thought of including this in the piece? That medication, if it has any role at all for emergent airway management, by whichever specialty does it, would be for a patient that had unanticipated difficult airway, meaning you performed an RSI, you can't intubate, and you decided to wake the patient up. Now, frenemy of the show, Ruben Strayer and George Kovach have both had conversations on why there is very little utility, if any, for this medication in emergency and critical care airway management, because basically what you're going to get at the end of it, if the patient manages to survive to wake up, will be the exact patient that required airway management to begin with. And it's usually even worse than before you started. But even in the anesthesia realm, I don't think this discussion has any relevance for a patient with a known upper airway obstruction because you should not be paralyzing those patients. There is no discussion in the article on awake intubation, which is, if you're going to discuss airway management, probably the most important thing to be discussing because patients with acute upper airway obstruction that you deem need airway management should be done awake in almost every circumstance. And the ways of going about that would have been an excellent topic of discussion for this article. It's not really there at all. Now, luckily on MCRIT, we've had an extensive conversation on all the perturbations and ideas that go into decisions on awake intubation. But let's talk specifically about patients with acute upper airway obstruction. You need to be very good at many tasks in order to be the one who performs airway management on these patients. And this goes into the geography in which this procedure should be done as well. So let's discuss this all a little bit. What do you need in your skill set if you're going to be the one to manage the airway of a patient you've deemed needs intubation for upper airway obstruction? Well, You need to know how to do a topicalized awake intubation. Now, I love ketamine-facilitated awake intubation. I use it extensively. I'm not sure it's the best move for these patients. I think you are better off just trying to mess with the system as little as possible, and that usually means topicalization. So you need to have that in your skill set, and you need to have the medications available to get it done. You need to be able to perform, in many cases, video bronchoscopic intubation. Now, in other things that push you towards awake intubation, physiologic perturbations, gross body habitus outside of the upper airway, doing things like video laryngoscopy with a bougie work out great. In this case, in many cases, the best move is a video bronchoscopic intubation. So if you can't do that, then it probably should be someone else managing this airway. But it goes further than that. Many emergency physicians, and for that matter, many anesthesiologists, learn to perform video bronchoscopic intubation solely from the head of the bed. But many of these patients, their only position of comfort in which they will not have severe respiratory distress is sitting up. And as a result, if you cannot perform a video bronchoscopic intubation face-to-face, then you are hindered. And probably if it's possible, you should get someone else in to do it. Now, in addition to the skill set of awake intubation, you also need someone, and it could be the same person, who is very comfortable and familiar with performing surgical airway. And we will discuss in a moment that piece of this article because it may be the most inflammatory part of it. But this necessity for these two roles, which may take place within the same person, will determine the geography of where this should be done. Now, if you're ever taking your oral boards and you get a patient with epiglottitis who requires airway management, the correct answer on the boards is usually send that patient to the operating room with anesthesia and ENT. And that's all well and good if the anesthesiologist is comfortable performing video bronchoscopic intubation. Many of them are. Some of them are not. And if ENT is available and in-house in a timely fashion. But depending on the skill set of the people involved, it may be very appropriate to manage the patient's airway in the emergency department. People are most comfortable and therefore perform best in the place that they are most familiar with. And for me, with a patient with an upper airway obstruction, since I feel quite comfortable performing surgical airway, as long as the patient's anatomy is conducive to it, and I know this ahead of time, and I am quite comfortable with topicalization and the performance of a video bronchoscopic intubation, I very well might choose to manage the patient's airway in my unit. On the other hand, for some of the patients I will encounter, given their individual circumstances, I very well might send that patient upstairs with anesthesia and ENT. It all depends on the situation and the people involved. Now, I mentioned the discussion in the article on surgical airway. This was surely the piece of the article that got people most upset, and I understand why. There were some mischaracterizations and a general tone of condemnation of cricothoracotomy, the implication that it's for untrained people as opposed to the experts who would perform tracheostomy. Now, don't get me wrong. I know Josh objected to this, but it's actually true. And many of the ENTs I know, they might actually perform an emergency tracheostomy rather than a cricothoracotomy, simply because that is their area of comfort, and they could do it with a relative speed very comparable to emergency cricothoracotomy. And in their minds, they are saving themselves another procedure. And it's on this latter point that I most object, and I will discuss that very shortly. But let's just discuss this. Anyone listening to this who is an EM doc, a intensivist or an anesthesiologist, I don't think you should perform a tracheostomy unless forced due to the absence of availability of the anatomical space to perform the cricothoracotomy. The cric is easier in all but the ENT's hands and will be more likely to be successful, is a safer place to cut. For a multiplicity of reasons, ignore the unstated but implied preference for a tracheostomy over a cricothoracotomy. It's just not true. Cric is excellent. Even if you were an ENT, I would urge you to perform the cricothoracotomy, but your comfort level will dictate what you do. But the implication of complication rates with cricothoracotomy in this article, they're completely wrong. And this wrongheadedness is not... The authors of this article are not alone in it, but it's their own literature from which a true understanding of this situation can emerge. Now, all the way back to the time of Chevalier Jackson, best name out there. Chevalier Weinger, what do you think? What do you think? No. Okay, fine. Chevalier Jackson condemned the cricothoracotomy, aka the high tracheostomy, for its horrible outcome in the patients he had observed. And basically, in his writings, banned it as an option. And this has continued to be perpetrated in the ENT literature. But what you must understand about Chevalier Jackson's condemnation was it is not, for almost every case, the cricothoracotomy we perform today. It was actually cutting through the cricoid cartilage or performing a cricothyroid between the first ring and cricoid cartilage, or through the first ring itself. This is a very different procedure than actually cutting the membrane between the thyroid and cricoid cartilage, which is what we call a cricothoracotomy today. And that procedure has a remarkably low complication rate when you compare it to things like tracheostomy. The dreaded fear of subglottic stenosis, which often brought patients to the operating room for conversion to tracheostomy with an immediacy, was, I think, predicated on this misunderstanding of these articles. And when you look at actual series performed using the techniques we do today, cutting the membrane between the cricoid and thyroid cartilage, the rates of subglottic stenosis in the right patient population are remarkably low, on the order of somewhere around a round number like zero. When you do see rates of subglottic stenosis, for instance, the 2% quoted in the New England Journal piece we've been discussing today, it is almost always when cricothyrotomies are performed on patients who had prolonged intubation and mechanical ventilation. And in all likelihood, the traumatization of the airway was actually from the indwelling endotracheal tube that was in there for those 2 weeks of mechanical ventilation and then performing a crike and leaving that there. And in those patients, tracheostomy is the preferred procedure, or a conversion of a cricothyrotomy performed emergently to a trach. But on the other hand, when the cricothyrotomy is performed as your de novo airway management technique, the subglottic stenosis rates are actually quite low. And some people will actually choose this as their primary area of choice. For instance, patients with a median sternotomy, a separation of the two incisions that could be provided by performing a crike instead of a trach is actually looked at as a bonus. And in one very large series on these patients, the subglottic stenosis rate was virtually nil. This dysphonia rates are the same situation. These 50% rates were taken from patients who had prolonged intubation and then a conversion to cricothyrotomy. You cannot look at dysphonia as being the fault of the crike necessarily in those patients. And when this procedure is performed de novo, for instance, for an emergency airway management, the dysphonia rates should not be anywhere near this high. Since tracheostomy is not without its severe complication rate, crike compares very well to tracheostomy, if not better. And I think for anyone except an ENT surgeon, it should be the emergency airway performance of choice. Now, if you want to see the literature that goes behind my statements, they will all be in the show notes. And these are all from either the ENT literature or the OMFS literature. And they say exactly what I did, which is Chevalier Jackson was not talking about what you think he was, that the rates for patients who did not have prolonged intubation for complications are very low. And this is probably the safest way to perform, certainly an emergency surgical airway. But this should be an option for patients who just need a bridge to get an endotracheal tube out and yet still need mechanical ventilation. And then those patients don't all need trachs. Now, what is the take home of this? Why am I discussing this to a resuscitation crowd? It means if you do perform a crike and then the patient goes up to the ICU, they do not need to go to the operating room if they're only going to be intubated for 2, 3, 4 days to get the trach placed. They could just keep their crike until they're ready for extubation when the swelling from upper airway obstruction or whatever the obstruction was has been fixed. So you do not need to send these patients to the operating room to get the crikes out. You can just leave the crikes in. Now, what this behooves you to do if you care about your intensivists is instead of putting an endotracheal tube in, put in an actual trach device. And for me, it will always be my friend, my companion, the 6-0 cuffed Portex, because its outside diameter is small, unlike the evil, overweight Shiley. So 6-0 cuff Portex, get them, put them in your emergency department. And when you have a patient with known difficult airway, put one of those at the bedside. Now, in the unrecognized difficult airway, the failed airway, you got to grab what's near you. But in a patient with upper airway obstruction who you're doing an awake intubation for and want a double setup, you want all the equipment necessary to perform a cricothyrotomy already available at the bedside, stick a 6-0 cuff Portex there as well, because if you put one of these in, it is a delight to manage these patients for 2 days with a cricothyrotomy. If on the other hand, you have an endotracheal tube sticking out of their neck, it is a disaster waiting to happen. And for me and my brethren up in the ICU, we'd really love something else, whether that means a slow, leisurely intubation from above, whether it means converting out that crike to a better crike appliance, or actually getting the tracheostomy performed. But I do not like endotracheal tubes sticking out a patient's neck for long term because they just want to be pulled out inadvertently. They are just begging for it. They are pleading with every piece of clothing that passes them to be yanked out. So just put the right thing in on the ones you know may progress to a surgical airway. Last thing to discuss that wasn't discussed in this article and probably should have been is the idea of awake cricothoracotomy or awake tracheostomy, in which in a patient who's deemed too tenuous to do RSI, which should be all of these upper airway obstructions, and in a patient who you know you're going to want a long-term access through the neck, because even if you intubate it from above, it's going to prevent you from doing the things you need to do to that upper airway obstruction, then performing an awake through local anesthesia, maybe a little anxiolysis, cricothoracotomy or tracheostomy is actually in some ways easier than performing an awake intubation from above in terms of patient tolerance and in terms of your capability of doing it. All the stress is off when the patient's still spontaneously breathing and you're performing a surgical airway. Now, you know, your decision may be altered by patients on anticoagulants, et cetera, but an awake cricothoracotomy, or if you're skilled, an awake tracheostomy is a not hard procedure. And now you have definitive access that still leaves the mouth open for any procedures the patient may need, or if you predict an extended course for the patient's need for mechanical ventilation for airway protection. So the fact that that wasn't there, again, inexplicable, being that this was written by ENTs. So I agree with all the people on Twitter. This was not a great article. I perhaps don't hate it as much as the people on Twitter, simply because I didn't expect much. These reviews in the New England Journal and similar major journals will never have the level of zoom that I want to actually have interest. And like I mentioned earlier, it's the same thing with presentations. If you want to wow me with a presentation, pick something incredibly small and then give me every bit of information on it, and I will be fascinated. Boredom is relieved by zooming in. And if you're going to do this broad-based scoping review article that's just basically a review of review articles, it's going to be bad.